Hello and welcome to the After Show Show, the show after the show, where we talk about things after the show. I mean, we did all watch Spy Kids recently, right? You've got some fantasy swears.
Fantasy swears are so hard because it's easy to make one that sounds refined, you know, like generally the way that you, because most swear words are either vulgar concepts or divine invocations.
Yeah.
So it's either like by whatever I worship or something to do with sex or like excrement. And those are kind of the only two, like the only two to three
fantasy
options.
Fantasy word for dicks.
Yeah, basically. But like the thing is, almost every fantasy story I've ever seen will just do like invocations of deities or deity-like things. It'll be like, by the stars. Like, that's a pretty obvious, like, that one applies in any world where there are stars. That's fine, whatever. Or like, by all the gods, that kind of thing. Or like whenever they have Thor swear, he always says stuff like, Odin's beard, which is very funny because it's like, my dad's beard. Anyway, but the thing is, all of that works if you're like a king or like a fancy elf or some shit. But like, if you need, you need something that matches the energy of like, what the hell? And like, you can't do that by being like, by all the stars. Like, that's a very different kind of character than somebody who goes, fuck, man. Like, so I've been struggling with this because like, either you make up a non-vulgar word for an in-universe vulgar concept, or you just avoid all of the specific like vulgar swears and just have everybody do like divine invocations for things, which works sometimes, but like I need swears that Faust can say, and he's not the kind of person to just be like, yeah, I'll start invoking the names and aspects of deities because I'm having a bad day. No, he's a what the hell guy, and I need something for that in a world that has no afterlife and no concept of hell. So, ugh. I mean, I'll figure it out.
The time that Family Guy made up a fake curse word and basically challenged people to find a definition for it such that they would have to get censored.
There was a plot point in an old school, like, D&D comic called Nodwick. And the premise was that there was a new swear word in town called Krutz. And everyone was like, dude, this thing feels so fucking good to say. Like, oh, I banged my toe. Krutz! Hey, I feel great now. And it turned out that it was, like, absorbing power for the use in some like evil, malevolent, necromantic ritual to resurrect somebody with all the combined like energy that everybody saying the swear word had accumulated. But it's really good. It's got all that perfect, like really hard sounds that you want from a good swear. Anyway, I think the problem I've been running into is that all the good fantasy swears, all the ones that sound cool, are like too formal. You need the informal cusses, you know? So that's been my grievance of the week.
I don't know how I'd even begin to approach that problem.
Yeah,
because
right?
Then it's like you have to do what IKEA does, which is where they have a team of linguists on their payroll who double and triple check every product name to make sure it's not a swear or a dirty word in some languages. You have to make sure that you're not just accidentally inventing like a real swear or like some horrible thing in some other language.
Well, this is a problem that they ran into in a lot of the Star Wars novels, because for a while, wherever they would use fuck, they instead used vape, a perfectly meaningless word that surely will never acquire any sort of implications. So you've got like pictures of pages of books where Anakin's going like, where's the vaping hover cycle? It's like, I don't know, buddy. It sounds like you should get a mechanic to look at that.
Periodic reminder that Star Wars Cantina music is called Jizz. They try to change it, but don't let them take it away from you.
Well, it's something in the Jizz Whalers, right?
Yeah.
That was something
so
crazy
when
we were in Iceland. There was this one bathroom in this one cafe whose name completely escapes me in Reykjavik that was just for some reason incredibly Star Wars themed. Like they were blasting one of the cantina band, the cantina music, the Imperial March, and like, you know, like Across the Stars just like on repeat in the background. There were these huge cardboard like life-size cutouts of like Leia and Han and everything. It had like LEDs around there. Did you guys go to that? I don't know if you were with us.
We didn't go to that one. I think that was on the first day that
crazy.
We were cutting ourselves loose in Reykjavik.
The whole cafe was very cute and covered in like this like eclectic like kitschy decor and stuff. But then the bathroom was just the one part of it that was deeply Star Wars themed.
I think if I was taking a poop and the Imperial March started playing,
it was ominous. It was a little creepy.
I would be intimidated.
It was like the last day we were there too. So right before we dipped out.
Boy.
I'm like, this can't possibly be my final memory of a Reykjavik.
No. Fantasy swears are weird. And like, obviously it's also a primo opportunity for world building, right? Because it tells you a lot about like what a culture's taboos are, you know, what things aren't spoken of and what things are too holy to be spoken of, because those are the two general ways that, like, and I'm sure there's really interesting like linguistic studies on this. I'm just kind of like freeballing it here because I don't really have the background to know this in depth, but from my observation of all the main swears, it seems to be either about taboo subject matters, either in terms of like, this is a gross and dirty thing we don't talk about in polite society, or this is a divine thing we only invoke in specific contexts, you know, don't take the Lord's name in vain, yada, yada, yada. And as a result, you mostly just get the coarse swear words and the rarer, like woofty, you know, what in God's name, or like, my favorite from the Shadow of the Colossus playthrough is the number of times I said sweet baby Jay. It's like at least three. I cut most of them out of the supercut because it was getting redundant. But like in a fantasy story, it's easy to find substitutes for the second category, but the first category, it's like, am I really going to have my Conan style barbarian character just saying fuck all the time? That just feels crass and weird.
Am I going to have to invent a new word for shit?
Yeah, because at that point,
good news, gamers, they invented shit too.
At that point, it just feels cutesy and ridiculous, you know? So yes, I'm struggling. I did have somebody say damn at one point, even though the implications of that annoy me. But, like, after a certain point, you gotta cut that off at the knees. Because, like, that sort of linguistic rabbit hole. Because it's like, you can't say goodbye if you're trying to avoid anything that is derived from real world religion. Because it means God be with ye. Like, there's no way to, like, it doesn't make sense. Except, you know, and the thing is, I see people doing this is kind of like a gotcha on a lot of fantasy stories. It's like, ha, they brought up champagne when they don't even have France. And it's like, guys,
it's
fucking
sparkling wine, you dumb fucks.
Just like touch grass or something. After a certain point, we all gotta assume it's translation convention, right? Like, we all know the hobbits aren't speaking English, you know? We all know that Meriadoc's real name is fucking Razal or whatever. So I don't know. After a certain point, I think it just turns into needless nitpicking. It's like, oh, did you want them to write the entire novel in a conlang that is perfectly accurate to the fake world that they made up and has absolutely no toeholds in reality? Would you read that? Would you really? Like, after a certain point, we have to accept the fact that, oh, you're speaking English in a world that doesn't even have England. Ha ha.
James Joyce has entered the chat.
Yeah.
He did that once, famously. I know.
I don't know. I think after a certain point, it's like, you're making a nitpick for a thing that cannot possibly be quote-unquote fixed.
Yeah.
Which just feels like you're scoring points
it's
off
like,
the thing.
There's a difference between, like, in episode one where Obi-Wan says, we're sitting ducks, Master, where it's like, okay, we've implied the existence of ducks in Star Wars. Like,
yeah, and further, duck hunting is a sport.
You have aliens that you could have subbed in. Like, you could have made that work and just didn't because you didn't proofread the script enough times.
Yeah.
Versus, like, something is fundamental to how language works as a phrase like goodbye, which is not immediately, you know, indicative of something as specific as ducks, but is still, like, derived from other things. It's like, are we acknowledging the Norman conquest by using English in this world?
Ugh.
Yeah.
Yeah, after a certain point, you just gotta accept it's in English because I speak English.
Yeah.
What are you gonna do about it? Yeah, but in specific things like that, it can be a little bit immersion break. And, like, after a certain point, you know, this just kind of just bumps up against suspension of disbelief. It's like, I am willing to suspend my disbelief that there's a thing that is a space duck that that Obi-Wan is referencing in this or whatever. But, you know, for my own personal integrity, I'm okay with using the English language, but I want to make sure that, like, the expletives don't borrow too heavily from the specific underpinnings of, you know, English. So, it's like, a fun little issue to have. Yeah.
Like, damn is a phrase, but hell is a place.
Exactly.
So, it's a lot easier to get away with saying damn than hell.
Yeah. It's like, damn and fuck are topologically similar, but, like, hell has all these implications. This one's going to be fun to find a promo for that will get us demonetized in the first 7 seconds.
Let's talk about Mission Impossible and Spy Kids. How about
we? So the context for this is that after we saw the eclipse, I feel like there was a certain amount of breaking of tension, because I know that I at least was like, I'm having a good time, but if we don't end up being able to see the eclipse because the weather doesn't cooperate, I'm going to be very upset and it's going to kind of be a downer. And I think that was a kind of a general sentiment in the gang, where it was like, Well, hopefully this works, because if not, this was a lot of effort for no payoff. And then we did see the eclipse, and it was awesome.
It was great.
I at least had a very good time.
Oh, yeah, no, it was a blast.
Yeah,
I had a great time.
I was just enjoying exhausted.
Being I'm in, like, placid. Yeah, I was going to say, like, kind of the opposite. I was like, I don't really care how the eclipse goes, because I've just been, this is my vacation for the next couple months. I'm going to enjoy 4 days in Lake Placid, hanging out, doing nonsense, bopping around. I played a Jurassic Park video game. I had a great time. And then
yeah,
the eclipse was really cool on top of that.
You had a great time at the arcade, that's right.
Awesome.
I did love that arcade.
Yes. Yeah. Well, I'm very glad, but there definitely felt like there was a certain, like, release of tension after that, because as soon as we got back to the hotel, it was like, let's, like, order pizza and make popcorn and watch a movie and then two more movies and just to, like, hang out and vibe and, like, sleepover energy.
Like,
and
it was great because the adrenaline completely left my body, so I didn't have the capacity to do fucking anything the rest of the day. So we were like, let's just put on something for the sake of putting something on. And then, like, 7 hours later, we finished Mission Impossible 1, hard jump to Mission Impossible 7, which was absolutely the move.
Oh,
and
yeah.
Then Indigo, you were like, let's watch the beginning of Spy Kids because that first 10-minute
yes.
montage is so much fun. And we're like, fuck
yes.
it, let's watch the rest of the movie, too.
Because I volunteered that I'd never seen Spy Kids. And you were like, oh, okay, cool.
It
just kept going.
Yeah,
just kept going.
It's a great movie.
It was great. We just watched, like, 7 hours of movies back to back. It was like an impromptu movie struck in person, and it was fantastic.
The jump from MI1 to 7, I think, was very interesting because it really made us realize how many purposeful callbacks 7 had to 1.
7 really leans into the vibe of 1 more than I think any of the more recent ones have.
Very full circle moment in a lot of regards, which I liked. And it was purposefully calling back to a lot of different things from across the Mission Impossible movies. But, like, seeing 1 back-to-back with 7 was very, very cool because it did feel like everything kind of came together. Because, like, one Mission Impossible to the next, there's rarely much in the way of continuity. Like, you know, you have the side characters that are still there between them, but the plot points kind of come and go because it's implied that there's, like, a few years between each major one. But when we get back to, like, oh shit, Kittredge is here.
Yeah, Kittredge is here.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, like, all the train stuff was really cool going from the TGV in Mission Impossible 1 to the Orient Express at the end of 7.
Oh,
and then what apparently has been confirmed, which I didn't realize, which is that Alana Matsopoulos is the daughter of Max from the first movie.
Yeah.
I was like, yeah, my personal theory is that Alana Matsopoulos is Max's daughter. And then the next day, Noir was like, hey, Blue, I looked it up. It's, like, confirmed in Mission Impossible 6.
Yeah.
And I'm like, oh. It's been a while since I watched that one.
Yeah. I will say, I mean, fucking cold take at this point. We were all talking about this. I know why they killed off the cool female lead, but, like, it's a very specific red flag for any long-running franchise if it keeps, like, if the male lead cast stays the same, but the female lead cast cycles out very quickly. To me, that's usually a little sus. That tells me, like, maybe, like, the pay's not good or the environment's not good and all these actresses keep leaving because of that or something like that. I don't know. It usually is something of a red flag. And, like, I absolutely loved that character when they brought
Elsa's
her in. And, like,
great.
Yeah, Elsa was in, like, what, 5? Was she from 5?
In 5. 5, 6, and 7. She's basically one of the main through line characters.
And, like, I know why they did it. She's in Dune now. She's going to be in, like,
she got stuff going on.
Yeah, she's got stuff going on. That's great. But still, it's like,
yeah.
Especially because they suddenly introduce in 7 this idea that, like, what was Ethan Hunt up to before he was in the Impossible Mission Force? He was having his female love interest die tragically in his arms. The villain's plan for the movie is to open his oldest wound again by having a female friend die tragically in his arms. I'm like, guys, there's a word for this trope. You're not going to like it. Coined by Gail Simone like a decade ago. We all
friend
know this
channel,
trick.
Friend of the show.
Follows us on Twitter along with, like, 10,000 other people. And it's just like, it was interesting. I actually found it very interesting because if we are accepting that, like, look, what they're doing is fridging the female lead, this was probably the best possible execution they could have done for that. They gave her, like, an honorable send-off. They acknowledged her, like, skill and prowess as a warrior. The sword choreography was a little garbage, but that's not her fault.
Okay.
That's the choreographer's fault. It's like, look, if my opponent has a tiny knife and I have a rapier, that man's not getting within 3 feet of me without getting holes punched in him, all right? That's what the point of a rapier.
Yeah.
Anyway.
Yeah. I feel like that worked for me because it, I mean, like, look, I rather it not have been a choice between two female characters, like, you know, Ethan Hunt can only save one kind of deal.
Just bring back Jeremy Renner. Let him die in his arms.
Let us not forget that Jeremy Renner was in these movies very briefly. Yeah.
4 and 5.
He said, next time I get to seduce the rich guy, he wants to be damseled so bad.
But I feel like that did help take some of the sting off of, like, well, she's making a very noble sacrifice. She's holding her own in the very end. Like, that it helped a little bit.
And it was the best possible execution of a deeply flawed trope. And that was interesting for me to see. Yeah. Like, they started from a flawed premise, but they did the best they could to sand all the edges off of it and produced something that I only hate on principle. But in execution-wise, like, I didn't have any additional grievances. I was like, this really felt like she was going off on her own terms. The villain specifically said, like, I'm going to kill this helpless Catwoman type unless you come and save her, Ilsa. And it's like, okay, yeah. So she made a noble choice, and she heroically sacrificed herself. And the fact that it was explicitly framed as a way to torture Ethan Hunt is shitty. But, like, whatever. Like, that's – if we're starting from that premise, this is the best way they could have done it. And I thought that was interesting. I thought it was a very interesting way to execute it. And also – oh God, what's her name? The actress.
Rebecca Ferguson?
No. Peggy
Vanessa
Carter.
Kirby.
No, the
Hayley Atwell.
Hayley Atwell! I love Hayley Atwell. She's great, and I'm excited to see her in a more action-y context. And it was interesting that they, at this point, like in the Mission Impossible series, everybody is so ludicrously overtrained and hyper-competent that it's like, all these people are turbo badasses. It's kind of weird to just bring in somebody who's like normal person good at what she does. Mm-hmm. It's like, she's a really good pickpocket, but she can't drive for shit.
She's skilled in one very particular axis, driving is not it.
And I remember we were noticing something similar when we did a movie night and watched Man from U.N.C.L.E. like a month or two back, because that also has like two main characters who are ludicrously badass and hyper-competent, but in two different directions. And it's like, Napoleon Solo, I can't believe that's his fucking name, is like the best safe cracker and gentleman the thief. And then Ilya?
I don't know his last name.
And then Ilya is like this fucking superhuman, super soldier, strongman badass who can't socialize for shit. And it's like, cool, I see how these two could really like complement each other in the field. That's fun.
Yeah.
You know, it's an art having characters who are super competent but not omnipotent. And I think MI7 really pulled that off in a way that I thought was fun.
And there's so many opportunities for characterization to come through at every point in the movie. Like with the driving, the chase sequence in Rome, it was very funny.
Yeah.
Red, you were like, oh, they're going to Rome. They robbed you of Venice. I'm like, don't speak so soon.
Well, because they said Venice and then they changed their minds, but then they changed their minds
and
again.
They diverted to Rome. Yeah, exactly. But it's like you have, you know, Tom Cruise, Ethan Hunt is very good at driving. Hayley Atwell is, Grace, is not good at driving at all. And then there's Pom Clementiva's Harris, who just drives a tank through the center of Rome, like grinning and screaming the whole time, running everything over.
I love the way that everybody's choreography extends out of the vehicle as well, because like we're introduced to Paris when she's driving that fucking tank and she's just wrecking shop. And then when we see her fighting Ethan in that alley, like she's like, look, Tom Cruise is a small man. I am reasonably certain that Paris is a little smaller than him.
Yeah.
I thought it was very impressive how she had this presence. It's like they're fighting in like a 2-foot wide alley and she's filling the space. It's like she's just moving forward like an inexorable bulldozer. And I just thought it was so interesting that the physicality of her character extended both in the car and outside of it. She's just this relentless force of nature who's utterly disregarding her own well-being and the well-being of anything around her in this destructive push forward, while everyone around her is being like tactical and dodging and sneaky and driving this adorable little buggy or whatever. And she's just like, fuck you.
Yeah, Cinquecento.
Yeah. So I thought that was really interesting. The way that they did, I think that like the main villain very much seems to be suffering from the fact that like, they rewrote the movie to have a bigger villain who he's like the right hand guy of.
Allegedly, the idea to put the entity as the main villain came like partway through shooting, which is like you can see the seams of that. You can tell it's like, oh, all this backstory with Gabriel like killing Ethan's like first wife or whatever is like, okay, it kind of clashes. It doesn't necessarily fit as well. But the fact that like any of the rest of the movie with the entity works and it's Gabriel who seems a little bit like wonky and out of place as opposed to the entity feeling tacked on is a testament to how well that plot point is integrated, because that easily could have fallen apart entirely.
I mean, we were very impressed at the very first scene of the movie with that doomed Russian sub.
It's the best scene in the franchise. I fucking love the submarine sequence.
They do a lot of really clever tricks to get us invested in this crew of people who we know from the jump are probably fucked.
Yeah.
And like, just that little gut punch. And the movie does this several times. The little gut punch where, oh no, it looks like they're going to die. Oh, good news, they're okay. Oh no, they're actually going to die. Like, because they did that shit with Ilsa. And I hated it, but that's fine. That was on purpose. I was supposed to hate it. It's good writing, I guess. But like in that specific case, it's like, just the little touch of, like, these guys in the sub bracing for, like, what they think is their inevitable doom. And it managed to draw on that that specific Cold War fear that the Mission Impossible franchise started steeped in and then sort of moved away from. And then they just dunk you back into it. Yeah. Like, hey, what's it like to be in a submarine knowing that it is very likely that you are going to fucking die in here? That, like, you're never going to go home. You're never going to see the sun again. How does that feel? And the answer is, when you think you have a torpedo coming at you, not good. And then when you think that you don't have a torpedo coming at you, oh, what a relief. And then when bad news, you absolutely have a torpedo coming at you. Oh, no. So, I don't know. Yeah, I thought that was very effective.
It's really well done. The music, Lorne Balfe's score in this movie is so fucking good. It starts off with all gas and does not let up the entire time. I love the way that the submarine is laid out. There's so many, like, cute little Orthodox icons all across. Like, you get the sense that this is a Russian submarine.
But also, it's a Russian submarine that they've kind of made a home a little bit, which makes it worse when they
explode. Isn't a house. It's a home at the bottom of the ocean.
This is also not
a
house.
Sea. But one of my favorite little details that makes this movie fit so well and feel so much more sinister on a rewatch is when you listen to the commander who's narrating, like something something Sevastopol Operation Podkova, on the word Podkova, you hear the little, like, churn that of the entity in the word. So you hear how the entity is already in the system. It's already fucking everything up. Information as fundamental as narration is already corrupted by the entity. It's so goddamn good. And the way it listens to what the captains are saying, like, it says it's at 1,500 meters, but the signal is too clear. It would have to be closer. And the entity's like,
oh, okay.
Good point. Closer then.
There were so many interesting things about this movie. There were a couple holes, actually, that make sense knowing that the entity was, like, added late. Because there's that bit where Benji is like, oh, no, I've got to put my car in self-driving mode. And it's like, yeah. Benji, we were just talking about this shit. But, like, that makes sense because clearly that whole, like, number at the end with the chase on the train and the launching yourself with the motorcycle off the convenient ramp-shaped rock spur, like, that was definitely locked in. But they couldn't ADR even a line of Benji being like, fortunately, my car is air-gapped, so I'll be fine. Like, because you look at something like that and you're like, the characters are intelligent, so they would not make this mistake. Except I've already seen the characters make this specific mistake when the entity got in the comms and was imitating Benji's voice. And Tom Cruise was just like, I trust what my digital earpiece is telling me, even though I know that we're fighting an unstoppable AI that is everywhere in the internet. So it's that very slight, like a gap that hasn't really been closed in the writing of, like, okay, I know Benji is too intelligent to make this mistake generally, but I don't know if I trust the writers to do that necessarily in this case. And it worked out okay because the entity was just like, okay, that's fine.
I'm excited to see what they do in the next movie because now they know what they're working with front to back. I'm really excited to see the entity fucking up more things for people. Because we get that with the first scene where it's listening, it's learning, it's adapting, and it's just destroying stuff. We get that in the sequence in the airport where Gabriel's being erased in real time. We get that in, like, the bag
sunglasses
thing. Yeah, except for the sunglasses.
Digital sunglasses. It's because Ethan Hunt's sunglasses have technology in them that the entity can make him not see the guy.
Which is so cool, and I love seeing that. And then, of course, with Benji's voice, and that's basically the last we see of the entity, you know, messing things up for people in the plot because there are only so many places you can put in it. I'm really excited to see the entity doing more of that in the next movie. So we'll see what wacky setups they can do because they establish so many capabilities that the entity has in the first movie, and we only get to see a few of them. So that'll be very, very exciting.
So my called shot is that either the entity or the entity's prototype code that is in the sub is going to manifest as a creepy but ultimately non-malevolent holographic child who just wants to understand and play. That is my called shot. That is always what they do with AI. And in this specific case, the AI seems to just be like, I don't want to be destroyed. And Ethan Hunt has the best chance of destroying me. That's when they're talking about, like, we can read its motivations by what it's trying to manipulate us into doing. But especially that first draft, the one that's still in the sub's code, I think that one is going to be a creepy little holographic child who's not actually malevolent, just wanted to play. Oh, no. Poor, just a little guy, and it's his birthday.
I just wanted to smash my little submarine toys together.
I mean, if you unleash a little learning tool that doesn't really have a concept of right and wrong into the most delicate piece of machinery with the most lives at stake, maybe the version that's rampaging around isn't evil. It's just like, oh, I've killed people. Oh, my play has killed people.
I mean, You've seen what happened when, like, chatbots go public and people can actually talk to them. They all become insane within days.
Well, yeah, but that's because they don't actually have long-term memory and they can't keep up the facade for any longer than, like,
five
minutes.
No, I mean, it's like, what was it like Cleverbot was interacting with people and then it went off the rails because the people it was talking to are all nuts?
Well, that's the problem with you let a learning algorithm learn from anything.
Yeah.
But anyway,
it's a movie that has no right to work as well as it does, given it's a part one of two. Yeah. It has basically an ethereal antagonist. It doesn't really resolve at the end because, like, the bad guy's still out in the wind. We're no closer to taking out the entity or Gabriel. We just have the key now. We have to go find the damn sub. But it's such a good goddamn movie. Every action sequence has all of the gas. There's so many fun set pieces. There's good, like, close-up in-camera action in addition to the big numbers of, like, driving down the Spanish Steps, which the credits of the movie has, like, a no animals were harmed in the making of this film, but it is, we didn't actually destroy the Spanish Steps in Rome. That stunt was conducted on a closed course. Don't worry, we didn't destroy precious cultural heritage.
Yeah.
It works so well. All the action's so good. I love the airport sequence where Degas and the other guy are, like, getting ready to go, and the guy's like, do not consider him neutralized until you have driven a wooden stake through his open heart. That is how people see Ethan Hunt, and it's so good to actually see that reflected out in dialogue.
And it's great because they've really earned that. Like, that's a level of, like, the dreaded that it's hard to justify any fictional character having in a lot of cases. But at this point in the franchise, you can absolutely be like, Ethan Hunt is an unstoppable, shape-shifting agent of chaos. It's just like, yeah, he basically is at this point.
Yeah.
They also do some fun little tricks with the camera that I thought was cute in terms of, like, anytime there is a secondary element of the scene that is important, it'll be blurred out in the background. And sometimes this is more subtle than others. There's this whole sequence early on where it looks like, oh, this guy just walked in and is staring, like, soullessly ahead, and every time they talk about the entity can have eyes everywhere, it just conspicuously cuts to this guy staring soullessly ahead, and it's like, oh god, what's in his briefcase? And then fucking surprise, it's Ethan Hunt, and it's like, well, yeah, obviously, but the camera, because every time it cut to him was like, oh, scary bad guy stuff being scary and bad guy-ish, oh no. Cary Elwes is in this movie for some fucking reason.
Yeah, and he's great.
I feel like ever since The Princess Bride, he was like, typecast me as slimy bad guys, because he's also in an episode of Leverage playing basically the same character. Anyway, good movie. And then we watched Spy Kids, which is a fun movie.
Spy Kids.
Not quite the same thing, but still very fun.
I remember exactly why the CGI monsters gave me nightmares, because those things are fucking, and even, like, the ones crazy in camera, like the little floopies or whatever they're called, I want to say those are all, like, real, like, masks and props and costumes, and they're goddamn horrifying.
Intentionally so, yeah.
Yeah.
It's interesting because, like, I can see how it is exactly of that era. It has exactly the same energy as pretty much all of the, like, brightly saturated straight to DVD, like Nickelodeon was putting out movies like that. It's got, like, live-action Timmy Turner energy. But it just happened to be...
That's cruel.
Well, look, I know that I'm on a call with people who are like, it's a good movie. And it's like, well, it's a fun movie. But, like, in terms of how it's put together, like, come on. It's really fun. It does what it's trying to do.
Like, I'm not disagreeing with you. It's just like, yeah, that's a strong way to phrase that. You're not terribly wrong, but it's like, oof, hadn't thought of it that way.
Well, but it's interesting to me because it is very much of that era, but it happened to be just good enough, just charming enough, just charismatic enough that it's like, oh, we can run with this. Because I know they made, like, a million more of those things, and
some
of them were
good. They made three Spy Kids movies. Let's not get crazy here.
All right, okay.
And then the whole the machete spinoffs.
Yeah.
Let us not forget.
Well, Robert Rodriguez, like, is a prolific director in his own right. And I think that the thing that works for me about Spy Kids, because, like, I watched it, I was at the right era for it, and I had a lot of nostalgia, and me and my boyfriend very recently went and rewatched all three of them, because we were like, we both love these movies as kids, let's watch them. And the first one, I would argue, is actually a good movie. I think if you can, like, I can understand being off-put by the design aesthetics and the 2000s of it all, but I think that you can't say a movie is bad based on the thumbs looking a little silly. Like, I do think that it does an incredible job.
I can say it's bad because the writing doesn't hold together, but that's okay.
No, but the writing holds together great if you consider that it is a movie that is, like, trying to capture what a kid's idea of a spy is. And I think that it's fantastic on those levels, and that's what it's trying to do. Like, I think it's incredibly successful in that.
It is good at that specific thing, and I'll certainly give it that. I just think... like, I don't know. I think my standard for a good movie kind of requires that the writing have not that many things that are, like, blatantly wrong with it. And the thing is, it is capturing child logic, I understand. This is also our point of contention about Speed Racer, where I'm like, there are many points in this movie that straight up do not make sense in the moment because the film language is confusing. There are also parts I really like, but there's a lot of it where I'm like, this is just not great. It's not great execution of what they're trying to do.
Brandon Sanderson's favorite movie?
And the thing is, in this specific case with Spy Kids, it's like, my very specific beef is just with the ending part, where it's like, we have to find a way to turn all 500 of these robot children good. And it's like, all right, Mr. What's-Your-Face, Pee-wee Herman-ass, you can use your computer to do
Cummings.
That. And he's yes. like, it's not that simple. I can't just push a button and turn them all good. And they're like, you gotta, all right, we're gonna go maybe fight them. And then they run off and he's like, oh, what am I gonna do? And then he's like, wait, I've got it. And then he pushes three buttons and they all turn good. And they're like, how did you do that? And he's like, well, I remembered that you are a good kid. So I did it. I pushed the button and now they're good. And it's like, wow, that explains everything. And it's like, if you set up that you need to answer the question, how can I turn all these robot children good? You cannot pay it off with, I just did it. Like, the puzzle pieces
like the
need to fit together.
That, though, isn't, I just did it. It's, our protagonist is a good kid and he taught them to be like the protagonist, you know?
I think it's, the story is operating on two levels, and one of them works and one of them doesn't. Mm-hmm. To try to merge these points a little bit here, I think it is definitely in my reading the weakest part of the story, but the rest of the story holds together pretty well, and it's got a lot of heart. So yeah. Even if the writing is not, like, technically at the highest level or holding together as well as, like, one would hope mm-hmm. movie would, it has all of the character beats and meaning and investment in this family, like, being a unit and being happy,
yeah,
that it's yeah. able to glide over some of those, like, narrative potholes, let's call it. So I'm not saying Spy Kids is my favorite movie. I think it is a good movie. I am terrified personally of the creatures, but that's just me. I think it looks as good as anything in like 2001 could have possibly mm-hmm. looked.
Yeah.
I don't think we did ourselves favors watching it on the tail end of two Mission Impossible movies. I think we, like, it was a very fun triple feature. But I think it did Spy Kids a little dirty.
Well, the thing is, like, I'm very strongly of the opinion that a thing can have really good parts while still having, you know, foundational flaws that I think could have been polished up and tightened up. I mean, also, I'm of the opinion that saying this isn't perfect but is an utterly meaningless statement because it applies to everything ever made. I think that, like, Spy Kids is certainly very fun. It's very charming. It's got a lot of heart. I can see why it, like, you know, rewired a lot of people's brains. I think calling it a good movie is conditionally true. It's very good at telling the story it wants to tell. Parts of it still bother me. I'm not saying, like, whenever I say I don't think this is good, I am never saying I think people shouldn't like it.
Oh, of course.
I love trash. Trash is great. I'm just saying, like, I think that something being a good piece of art has a specific space of meanings. And this might be a personally held opinion, but I think there are a lot of things where it's like, I love this, this is great, but that doesn't mean it's good, you know, that kind of thing.
I can understand where you're coming from. Like,
I'm going to self-alt here, because one of the movies I do not classify as good because of this metric is 2001 A Space Odyssey, because it utterly falls apart as soon as he does the light beam. It stops telling its story and just starts putting things on the screen. I think it is at that point bad at being a movie. This is my most heretical movie opinion, and this is why, if you don't want to take my take seriously, this is the justification.
It's not Ultron, gang, it's this.
Because I'm the dumbass who thinks that 2001 isn't good at being a movie after a certain point.
Yeah.
I'll I'll qualify it as saying, I think Spy Kids is good. I wouldn't call it great, but I think it's good. It's just a difference of definitions.
I'm not going to ride or die for Spy Kids the way I ride or die for Speed Racer. But, like, I think Spy Kids is fundamentally a good movie because I've watched all three, and I can now say the first one is just a good movie. Like, it's just a well-made execution of a concept. The second one is fine. It's got a good... It's fun to watch Steve Buscemi in it, but it's nonsensical. And then the third one is, like, fun. You know, like, the third one's like, you've watched two, now you're having a good time with, like, the cameo fest, like, crazy CGI 3D. And I think the first one is, like... I think I'm a little less adherent to the rules of storytelling if the concept is executed well, particularly with movies when it comes to whether or not something is good. Because I feel like there is a certain degree to which you can play with how a story is constructed and still come out the other side with a good movie. And that's where I think, like, this is where I think our point of convergence would be on things like 2001 Red. Because I'm like, I would still say that that's a good movie, but I understand how, like, by the story wheel of it all, it might start to disintegrate a little bit. And I think that that's maybe where the disconnect is with Spy Kids too, because I'm like, you know, it's not a flawlessly constructed story. I think that they do an amazing job of constructing a simple story that, like, a kid could understand and that works on kid logic, and that makes it work. And I think that it's still a good film. Like, I still, like, I think it's it holds together incredibly well. But, you know, I'm not going to sit here and tell you that, like, to overcome all of the issues, like, you like what you like what you don't. But I would push back on the idea that it's, like, fun but not a good movie, because I think it's fun and a good movie. And then the later ones are where you start to get into no longer good movies but still kind of fun.
I will very quickly posit Spy Kids 3 is a great point of comparison, because Spy Kids 3 is fun as hell and
so
dumb
fun.
As shit.
I'll terrible movie, so it, fun. Yeah, so I love it so much.
That's the difference.
It's not a good movie.
That's the difference for me. Spy Kids 3, not a good movie, so much goddamn fun. Spy Kids 1 is fun, and it's pretty good. Go ahead.
Well, the thing that I just kind of realized about the way I make this judgment is if I encounter something that I read as, like, an error that I sort of theoretically know how to correct, I'm like, they should have fixed that. Because, like, what the fuck do I know? And in that specific case, like, the specific grievance with, like, the ending thing, it's like, oh, I need to turn these robot kids good. Oh, I've got it. I can turn them good. Like, that's, you know, it's whatever. But it's like, if you set up to solve this problem, I need to figure out the way to turn these kids good. Solution, I have figured out a way, and it is this. If you establish a problem, you generally need to then provide the solution to the stated problem. And if you want the solution to be, you are a good kid and that taught me, like, child psychology enough to figure out how to turn these evil robot kids good, like, that's one thing. But then the stated problem needs to be different. And it can't be like, it's not going to be as simple as pushing a few buttons when it turns out to be as simple as pushing a few buttons. Like, that kind of thing to me reads as, like, a little strike slip error in the writing. And I think that that would have been a pretty easy thing to fix, because it's, like, just a little, like, the puzzle pieces need to fit together. I keep bouncing my mic. I'm so sorry. But
It's very fair. For me, I think the reason it doesn't bother me as much is because, one, like, the solution isn't terrible. It's the setup of the problem that's bad.
Exactly.
But also, that's not the main resolution of the movie. The main resolution of the movie is the family learns how to trust each other, support each other, and be
the
open.
And busts through the window. They finally have all the people they need to get the family together.
Right, but then at the same time, what do they do when they have all five of them there? They kind of cower from the robots, and then the robots get solved because he figured out the very three buttons to push.
But who the was family the comes family together member? At the end, which, like, if that didn't work, the movie would feel so much worse. Then it's like, okay, like, they don't actually fight the kids. The spy kids, the robots, like, on the floop side, and the, like, machete showing up, and then nothing actually happens side, like, that's a fault. Okay. But, like, the core character arcs of, like, this family learning how to trust each other, the parents, the siblings, then the parents to the siblings, like, those all work. And if that didn't work, it would be a much worse movie overall. So, like, for me, because that, like, I'm willing to let a lot of things slide on that. I don't think we're terribly far off from each other in all of this,
no,
the three of us. I think it's just a matter
agreeing,
of definitions.
We all had a good time
and, like,
watching
where
Spy
we
Kids.
Draw our lines.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Yeah. As a movie night, it was a blast.
Yeah. Yeah. Definitely. I think in general, I define things as good if they have the least wrong with them. And I don't know if that's the universal definition that we're adhering. Like, something can be fun and have a lot wrong with it. But for something to be good, I generally need it to feel a certain degree of, like, polished up, you know, errors corrected, like, falls speckled over. But, like, the thing is, I had a really good time, and I am curious about the other movies in the series. So, like, it's definitely, it did a lot of things really right, and I had a great time. And honestly, it's just fucking so fun to see Antonio Banderas in things.
I mean, Antonio Banderas is beyond incredible charming. Like, that the reason I wanted us to watch this is because the first 10 minutes of that movie where the mother is sitting down and telling her children the story of the two spies who, like, fall mm-hmm. in love. And, like, that whole spy wedding sequence is, I think, some it's of perfect. The greatest spy media ever made. And it is Absolutely. Just the opening for Spy Kids.
Mr. Yeah. fucking wishes it had.
Yeah, like, and what, the level of romance, both in the, like, love sense and the type of adventure sense, the like uh-huh. understanding of what makes a spy and what makes a spy cool that is on display in like 5 minutes of screen time is absurd. Yeah.
And at the same time, like, the writing on that is awesome, because when the mother is telling the story, like, the father is framed as this like dashing, effortlessly charismatic, and then as soon as we see him in person, he's this, like, he is a badass, but he's also an absolute goober, and it's like, oh, we're kind of seeing him through, like, waifu vision, and it's easy for us to be like, yeah, he's Antonio Banderas, of course he's basically Zorro, but then it's like, Zorro was also kind of a dumbass, like, we saw the movies.
If the beginning of the movie wasn't that good, the rest of the movie would not have worked as well as it does, and that first 10 minutes is nearly perfect cinema, as far as I'm concerned.
It's
so
cute.
Much fun.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think everything that was reliant on, like, the family is learning to love and trust each other properly. Like, they all love each other, but now they're learning to trust and function as a family and be honest with who they really are. It's, like, perfect. No notes. Absolutely delightful. And the child actor performances are tolerable to good.
Yeah.
Which is pretty fucking impressive.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. We are coming up on time for the After Show, as much as I would love to continue.
Oh, are we not over time? I wasn't sure.
We're definitely over time, but I was trying to be generous.
Yeah,
so
okay.
I like talking about Spy Kids.
Yeah, couldn't tell.
Also, one thing we didn't get to talk about is that Mission Impossible 7 is so funny. It's so funny. There's so many, and it's not like they're telling jokes.
We can't open up a new topic
humor.
Now. Like, we gotta sign
That's where it starts and ends. That's where it starts and
no,
ends.
It's not,
just that.
Because there's the specific comedy of Ethan Hunt being like, Benji, you can't seriously be suggesting that I ramp this motorcycle off this cliff and then paraglide down onto a moving train in order to adhere myself to it, while inside him you can see Tom Cruise being like, hee-hee-hoo-hoo-hoo-hoo-hoo. Like, I think you described it as like Tom Cruise and Ethan Hunt are like fucking Smeagol and Gollum.
Yeah.
The other way around, where it's like,
jump the cliff.
No!
Jump the cliff.
I can't eat myself off to the Taj Mahal, Precious. Do it. It's going to be such a sick shot.
And then
Precious.
My favorite bit is when they're trying to clear everyone off, and a guy's like, Madame say Monsieur, and the other guy comes in like with a gun. All right, everybody off. Perfect. Perfect. Anyway,
good movie.
That was
Blue,
wonderful.
Please.
Red, do you want to take us out of the After Show?
I don't care who does it. Someone's got it.
Am I being dignified with my old position back? Thank you all so much for listening to the After Show Show. We'll be back in 2 weeks with another episode of the podcast and presumably also an After Show Show. I don't think we've yet wrangled how we're going to do that with a guest, but I'm sure we'll figure it out.
Well.
It's going to be a fun time regardless. Pins, check out pins if you have not already. They are still pins present where pins are sold, which is overlysarcastic.shop. Huh, I don't normally lead out the After Show Show. The script is not as good. So this one isn't my fault. But
you're doing great.
Thanks. I think that's basically everything we needed to talk about. So bye. Have a good time, everybody. See you in 2 weeks. Watch the Eclipse video when it comes out on Friday. Okay, bye. Ooh.